Imagine that you are a kindergarten teacher. It's late in the afternoon on a cold winter's day, and the kids in your class are just starting to get ready to go home. A little boy in your class says, "Teacher, can you help me get my boots on?" And you can see why he's asked, because with him pulling and you pushing, by the time you get the boots on both his feet, you've worked up a sweat. He stands up, looks down at his boots, and says, "Look, teacher, we put them on the wrong feet." You sigh, help him pull his boots off again, and then proceed to get them, wrestle them back on again. He stands up, looks down at his boots, and says, "These aren't my boots." So you pull, maybe rip, the boots off his feet again, only to hear him say, "Actually, these are my brother's boots. My mom made me wear them today." Now, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. You get the boots back on him one more time. You stand him up, hand him his coat, and say to him, "Now, where are your mittens?" "Oh," he says, "I forgot. I stuffed them in the toes of my boots." If you were that kindergarten teacher, how would you react? In situations like that, how do you typically react? Today, we're continuing in our sermon series about what it means for us to be salt and light in this world. What it means for us to be the hands and feet of Jesus in this world. We've already seen that the power to do that comes through what the Apostle Paul refers to as life in the Spirit. In Galatians 5:22, Paul identifies for us 9 core characteristics. I think last week I misspoke and said 7 core characteristics. It's 9 core characteristics of someone who is living a Spirit-filled life. We've already covered 4 of those 9 characteristics: love and kindness, peace and joy. Now today we're tackling 2 more: gentleness and patience. Recently, I had my patience tested. It turns out I'm negative. How about you? If you were that kindergarten teacher, how would you react? Let's start with a prayer. Jesus, we want to become more like you because you are so beautiful. And we want that beauty to radiate out of our lives in an aggressive, reactive, hostile, temperamental world. Show us how to be different, how to make a difference, how to be salt and light. We ask this in your holy name. Amen. Today's gospel passage is a classic example of how much can be lost in translation. In English, we have one word for love, love, that has to carry the weight of many different shades of meaning. But as we've seen in prior weeks, in the language in which the New Testament was originally written, an ancient dialect of Greek, there were multiple words for love, each with different shades of meaning. It turns out those different shades of meaning are absolutely critical to us understanding what's happening in the dramatic dialogue between Jesus and Simon Peter in today's gospel passage. First, let's step back and set the stage for today's story. You recognize today's scripture passage as the same one we read a few weeks ago on Easter Sunday, though today we're going to look at it from a very different angle. The backstory to today's gospel passage is that the night before Jesus' crucifixion, Simon Peter, on three different times, denied he ever even knew Jesus. This from the one who just a few days before that had swore that even if everyone else abandoned Jesus, he would be right there, the last man standing, even if that meant risking his life. But then he turns around and does the very thing he swore he would never do. His spirit was broken by that. And so Simon Peter gave up on his discipleship path, returned to Galilee to resume the life of a fisherman. That's where today's gospel passage picks up. Peter and some friends are fishing offshore when they look up, and on the shore they see Jesus, the risen Christ, beckoning to them to come into shore and share breakfast with him. This is the first time Jesus and Peter have had a chance to have a conversation since Peter denied Jesus three times. This is the dialogue that ensues. John 21:15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Peter said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Wait right there, though. Because if we were reading this passage in its original language, we would see that there is a level of meaning to this question and answer that escapes us when it's written in English. Jesus' question to Peter in the Greek dialect was, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me more than these?" Remember what agape means. We saw it a few weeks ago. It is the highest form of love, divine love, the kind of love that Jesus had for us on the cross of Calvary, an unconditional and sacrificial love. So Jesus is asking Simon Peter, "Do you love me enough that you would sacrifice for me?" Peter's response is, "Yes, Lord, you know that I philo you." Notice that Peter does not mirror Jesus' word, agape. He uses a different Greek word for love, a lesser Greek word for love. Philo is great, but it's not agape. Philo, loosely translated, means I'm fond of you. I really like you. So Jesus says, "Do you love me so much, so unconditionally, that you would sacrifice for me?" And Peter responds, "Yes, Lord, you know I'm fond of you." Because Peter understood that given what he had done, three denials of ever even knowing Jesus when the chips were down, Peter knows that he cannot possibly credibly claim to love Jesus in the deep and sacrificial sense. So the dialogue continues. In verse 16, a second time, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me?" Peter says to him again, "Yes, Lord, you know that I philo you." The tension is mounting in this conversation. Suppose you've been dating someone and you say to that person, "Do you love me?" And suppose she says back to you, "I'm very fond of you." And you say, "No, no, that wasn't what I asked. Do you love me?" And she tweaks your nose and says, "I'm very fond of you." It's not exactly what you're getting at. So Jesus continues to press. But notice the difference this third time around. In verse 17, Jesus said to Simon Peter a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you philo me?" Now Jesus is choosing Peter's word. It's as if he's saying, "So, you're fond of me, are you?" And Peter starts to get emotional. Peter felt hurt because Jesus said to him on this third time, "So you just follow me?" And Peter said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I follow you." In other words, Peter was saying, "Jesus, you know everything. You know what I did. You know that I cannot possibly, credibly, look you in the eye and say I love you with a deep, unconditional, sacrificial love because I've proven that I didn't. Why do you think I gave up on my faith journey? Why do you think I came back to Galilee to resume the life of a fisherman? I'm not worthy of you." And now, Jesus is ready to bring home the point that he's been driving toward. Jesus looks Simon Peter in the eye and he says to him, "Feed my sheep." Actually, it's the third time in this dialogue Jesus has made that point. "Feed my sheep." Do you see what he's doing there? He's saying, "Peter, I know what you did. I know that your love for me is imperfect at best, but I love you unconditionally. I know that you've got a lot of growing left to do, but I still want you to be a leader in my movement. You can grow. You can develop. Let's keep walking this journey together." And what Peter hears in that is that Jesus still wants him, flaws and all. What a beautiful example of how God interacts with us. Incredible patience. Let's try those boots one more time. Amazing gentleness. When Jesus had every right to scream and holler at Peter, when Jesus had every right to be harsh and judgmental, to call him down and to call him out, Jesus instead says in the final analysis, "I love you unconditionally, just as you are." That amazing grace, mediated through Jesus' gentleness and patience, is exactly what Simon Peter needed to get up off the mat and get back in the game. You may know the rest of the story about Simon Peter's life. How after this pivotal moment when Jesus resuscitated his faith journey through his gentleness and patience, Simon Peter would then go on to become the preeminent leader of the early Christian movement, the rock upon which Jesus would build that first Jerusalem church. Simon Peter, throughout the decades that would follow until he was an old man, traveled across the Roman Empire, boldly proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ, ultimately, as best we can tell, settling in the capital of the Roman Empire, settling in Rome, where he became the preeminent leader of the Christians in Rome. And during Nero's persecution, Simon Peter was arrested. And once again, he was asked that question: "Do you know Jesus? Are you one of his followers?" And this time, Peter's ready to say, "I am." He is sentenced to crucifixion, just like Jesus before him. Except according to church tradition, Peter said, "I am unworthy to die in the same way as my Lord died. I want to be crucified upside down." Nero was glad to oblige. So that Peter the denier ultimately became Peter the martyr. Peter's philo ultimately became full-blown agape. Peter finally reached the greatness of agape love, all because at that pivotal moment when he was ready to quit, instead of speaking harshly or judgmentally to him, Jesus gently and patiently lifted him back up again. Peter's story reminds me of something that King David once said Looking back on his life, King David in the Old Testament, the book of Psalms, talking to God, King David once put it this way. He said, "You have given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand supported me, and your gentleness made me great." I love that last phrase. Your gentleness made me great. With gentleness and patience, God seeks to coax the greatness out of each one of us. And if God does that for us, shouldn't we do that for others? If Jesus patiently and gently coaxed Simon Peter back to a place of hope, if we want to be the hands and feet of Jesus, shouldn't we be treating the people around us the way Jesus treated Simon Peter? And in fact, the New Testament repeatedly calls us to do exactly that. For example, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1. Lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you. Yet, do it with gentleness and respect. 2 Timothy 2:24, the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring evil, correcting your opponents with gentleness. John Wooden was a basketball legend. He was the legendary coach of the UCLA Bruins, the men's basketball team at UCLA, back in the 1960s and 1970s. He was there for a total of 12 years, and in those 12 years, John Wooden led them to 10 NCAA men's basketball championships, unparalleled in sports history. Wooden may well be the greatest coach in the history of sports. He was, by the way, a devout follower of Jesus. He was also born and raised here in Indiana, out in the hinterlands. Back then, when he was a little boy, it was common, probably still is here in Indiana, to have deep gravel pits that dot the landscape, and farmers back then would often hire out their plow horses to pull heavy wagon loads of gravel up out of the gravel pits. John Wooden told the story how one day he and his dad were in one of those gravel pits and watching as a young farmer was getting furious with his two beautiful plow horses, because he wanted those plow horses to pull a heavy load of gravel up out of that very steep pit, and they were resisting. So the young farmer was cursing and whipping those horses. The horses were frothing at the mouth, stomping their feet, pulling back from that young farmer. Wooden's dad was distressed by what he was witnessing, so he decided to intervene. He said, "Let me give it a try." Wooden would later write about what he saw his dad do next. He said, "Dad started talking to the horses, almost whispering to them, stroking their noses with a soft touch. He walked between them, holding their bridles in bits, while continuing to talk calmly and gently as they settled. Gradually, he stepped out in front of them and gave a little whistle to start them moving while he guided the reins. Within moments, those two big plow horses pulled the wagon out of the gravel pit as easy as could be, as if they were happy to do it." He goes on to say, "I never forgot what I saw Dad do that day and how he did it. Over the years, I've seen a lot of leaders act like that angry young farmer who lost control. So much more can usually be accomplished by my dad's calm, confident, and steady approach." And that is exactly how John Wooden coached his basketball teams. He became famous for his preternatural calm. No Bobby Knight hysterics. Apologies to Bobby Knight fans, but no Bobby Knight hysterics in the heat of the moment. When his players were misfiring or not listening or doing something wrong, he coached them just like his dad interacted with those plow horses in the gravel pit decades before. And because of that, he got more out of his players than any coach ever in the history of sports. Your gentleness made me great. Just as Jesus patiently, gently mentored Simon Peter to greatness, John Wooden patiently, gently mentored his players to greatness. Just ask Bill Walton, the most famous player who ever played for him. He goes on and on about what he learned from John Wooden, especially his patience and his gentleness. That is beautiful. Talk about being different. Talk about making a difference. Talk about being salt and light. We who would follow Jesus are called to be like that. But of course, it's easier said than done. In the heat of the moment, when we're all fired up and somebody's got on our last nerve and we just want to lash out. Picture it. A young mother is in a grocery store. Her little girl is riding in the grocery cart. As mom is pushing up and down the aisles, the little girl gets cranky and then outright belligerent, to the point that she's crying loudly, and at one point she reaches out and knocks something off the shelf that mom has to pick up again, and then she takes something, the little girl takes something that's in the cart and tosses it out of the cart. The whole while, her mother is speaking very calmly. Easy does it, Samantha. Keep calm, Samantha. It'll be over soon, Samantha. A stranger who's passing by can't help but stop and compliment the mom, saying to her, "You really know how to talk to an upset child." And then the stranger leans down and says to the little child, she says to her, "Are you having a bad day, Samantha?" Whereupon the young mother says to the stranger, "That's not Samantha, that's Brittany. I'm Samantha." Easy does it, Samantha. Stay calm, Samantha. It'll be over soon, Samantha. That's the inner struggle, right? Somebody is testing us, and we're about to blow a gasket. Somebody has cut you off in traffic, or maybe your spouse has left your shoes in the middle of the floor, and you've told her 100 times before, and you almost trip over them again, and you've just had it. How many times do I have to tell you? Or your child is getting on your last nerve, or your boss, or your coworker getting on your last nerve, or your best friend has just made the same stupid mistake for the 15th millionth time, and you just want to say to him, "When will you ever get a clue? Why do you keep doing the same stupid thing over and over again?" It's easy to say, be patient, be gentle, but it's hard to live it. One of my pet peeves is that churches spend so much time telling us what to do and so little time telling us how to do it. So, in the few minutes that we've got left today, I want to offer three suggestions that might help us cultivate greater gentleness and patience in our lives. And then in our Oasis groups this week, we'll brainstorm for some additional ideas. So, when you find yourself in a situation where the temperature is rising, your annoyance is growing, and you're about ready to lash out at someone, suggestion number one is, insert circuit breaker, get in the habit of practicing sacred pauses. Let me explain what I mean. As your temperature is rising and you want to just blurt out something impulsively, catch yourself and deliberately step back, take a deep breath, count to 10, and ponder what you're about to say, so that when you do say something, it will hopefully make the situation better instead of worse. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 28, the mind of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil. No filter. Pastor Gordon MacDonald tells the story of a time he was good friends with an elderly couple, Dr. Paul and Edith Reese. They'd been married for like 60 years. So one day Gordon says to Paul, after 60 years of marriage, do you and Edith still experience tension in your relationship? Paul says, oh, yes. He says, for example, the other day we were out driving and she was behind the wheel and she ran right through a stop sign, like to have scared me to death. Gordon said, well, what did you do? Well, Paul said, after I caught my breath, I said, Edith, dear, after our nap today, there's something I want to discuss with you. Because he went on to explain to Gordon that he said, I've loved Edith for 60 years. And in that time, I've learned that a thing or two about her. He says, I've learned that when she was a child, her dad would always speak harshly to her. And so whenever somebody speaks harshly to her, that triggers her. So he says, I have learned not to jump out there in the moment, but to hold back. So I said to her, Edith, after our nap today, there's something I want to discuss with you. And that's what I did, Paul said. When our nap was over, I was calm. She was ready to listen, and we had a great conversation. Now, I know that story sounds kind of quaint, maybe even old-fashioned, you know, Ozzie and Harriet-like. But it also sounds wonderful to me. Being patient and gentle does not mean avoiding the hard conversations. It's all about timing, tone, and attitude. So in the heat of the moment, when we find ourselves ready to blurt out harsh words, check yourself, insert circuit breaker, pause for a few seconds and ponder, because great marriages or relationships of any type are never built on harshness. Your gentleness made our relationship great. So let's intentionally resolve to practice sacred pauses. At first, it may seem awkward. Be calm, Samantha. Easy does it, Samantha. But practice makes perfect. You'll get in a rhythm, and you'll save yourself and the people around you a lot of pain and heartache. It's not about avoiding the conversation. It's about the timing, the tone, the attitude. Suggestion one. Suggestion number two, empathy. Try to imagine what it feels like to be that other person and how they got that way. It's an important part, I think, of what Jesus meant when he said, love your neighbor as yourself. When I do crazy and annoying things, I tend to cut myself slack because I know me. I know the reasons why I do the crazy and annoying things. I know the whole backstory, so I tend to cut myself slack. Loving our neighbor as ourself means trying to imagine their backstory. What is that person feeling? And how did they get that way? Empathy. I once heard a story that made a big impression on me and has helped me since when I reflect on this story. A woman was in a grocery store, another grocery store story, but a different one. A woman was in the grocery store, and she was kind of in a hurry to get a few things. As she was headed down one aisle, she came up behind an elderly couple that were going as slow as molasses. Between the two of them and their shopping cart, they were managing to blockade the entire aisle, creating a kind of traffic jam behind them, apparently oblivious to the world. Talking as they went, slow as molasses. And of course, she internally was thinking to herself, would you get the lead out, please? Don't you have any situational awareness? But as she was blockaded behind them, she overheard a part of their conversation that caused her to realize that this elderly woman had terminal cancer. And this was probably the last time she and her husband would ever be able to go to the grocery store together. So they were savoring the moment. Now, waiting behind them didn't seem like so much of an imposition. The point being, there's a story behind everything. There are reasons why we are the way that we are. Do you think I would ask to be like this? I mean, look at me. I'm a little bit obsessive compulsive. Okay? I'm a lot obsessive compulsive. I'm wired pretty tight, but there's a story behind that. Just like there are reasons why you are so annoying and aggravating. And yes, I'm thinking specifically of you when I say that, because it's true for all of us. So let's be gentle. Let's be patient with each other. Ruth Graham used to like to say, "When I die, I want them to put on my tombstone, 'End of construction. Thank you for your patience.'" Just like you see out on the highway. End of construction. Thank you for your patience. Like her, we are all in process. Like Simon Peter, we're all somewhere between Philo and Agape. God is patiently growing us to greatness. Don't we owe the same thing to the people around us? So, when you're tempted to lash out, try to imagine what it feels like to be that other person and how they got that way. Lastly, third suggestion, create space in your life to decompress. Think about it. When you're about ready to lash out at somebody, when you're getting really aggravated and annoyed, it's almost always because you have been pushed to your limit. Life is so demanding. We jump from one thing to another thing to another thing until we are completely depleted. And then somebody does something that gets on our nerves, and we have no available reserve of emotional and spiritual energy with which to respond well, so we just blurt it out. In his book, The Rest of God, Mark Buchanan tells about a time when a friend of his recently asked him, "What's your deepest regret in life?" Mark says, "I thought briefly about my failures, my losses, my sins. But then," he says, "I said to my friend, my greatest regret is all those times in life when I've been in a hurry." His friend said, "What?" Mark goes on to write in his book, he says, "My greatest regret is being in a hurry, getting to the next thing without fully entering into the thing already in front of me. I can't think of a single advantage I've ever gained from being in a hurry. But 1,000 broken and missed things, tens of thousands, lie in the wake of all my rushing. Through all that haste, I thought I was making up time. It turns out I was throwing it away." He goes on to say that the Chinese word for busyness is created by joining two characters, two other Chinese words together, the character for heart and the character for killing. What an interesting insight. Busyness kills the heart. Buchanan goes on to say, "The heart is the place the busy life exacts its steepest toll." Which is precisely why the Bible gives us the Sabbath command. Whether you're taking a full day a week for your Sabbath renewal, or whether you're taking incremental time frames throughout the week that added together equal a full Sabbath day, whichever way you're doing it, I hope you're doing it. I hope you are regularly inserting buffer zones in the midst of all of your busyness, in between those bursts of activity, make sure you're creating buffer zones, quiet times, where you can decompress and detoxify. Because quiet time to the soul is what the liver and kidneys are to the body. If you don't get enough quiet time, you become toxic. And toxic people are not gentle or patient. Writing in the magazine Psychology Today, psychologist Guy Winch, in an article about how we can cultivate greater patience and gentleness, he makes precisely this point. He uses different terminology, but the critical importance of Sabbath rest, either a day at a time or incrementally throughout the week. He puts it this way: find a quiet place to think things through or to disengage from the commotion and activity around you. Irritability can be your mind's way of alerting you that you need a break. So take one. Listen to music. Do some stretching or yoga. Meditate. Take a bubble bath. Go for a walk. When you're done, take a deep breath and prepare yourself to re-engage so your system isn't shocked back into irritability once you re-enter the fray. Psalm 131:2. I have calmed and quieted my soul like a small child with its mother. My soul within me is like that small child. Get away from the craziness. Dare to get into the quiet, where the still small voice of God speaks, where your spirit rests and renews, and you replenish your energy supply, so that when you are tested for patience, you turn up positive because you've got that reserve to draw on. Let me close with this. Back in the 2009 Major League Baseball pennant race, the Philadelphia Phillies were playing the Washington Nationals in a pivotal game. Huge Phillies fan Steve Montforto had managed to snag two tickets to the game, albeit in the upper deck. So there he was in the upper deck, front row of the upper deck, right by the railing, his young daughter, 3 years old, right beside him. He brought his daughter to this great game because he wanted to share that with her. At one point, a foul ball arcs high in the sky, lofting toward them. Instinctively, he jumps up, leans a little bit out over the rail, and catches the ball. Now, if you're a baseball fan, you know that one of the dreams of every Major League Baseball fan is that someday in a Major League stadium, you will catch a ball. It had happened for Steve. Some baseball fans can live and die an entire life, and it never happens for them. So he's sitting down, his precious Phillies baseball in hand, elated at what has just happened. He turns to his daughter and says, hands the ball to her and says, "Look what Daddy got." And she proceeded, before he even realized what was happened, to do what any kid would do when they get a ball. She reared back and threw it over the rail to the lower deck. Those who were there say most everybody in the stadium gasped and waited to see what Dad was going to do. At first, he looked stunned. Then he reached over, pulled his daughter close, and gave her a big hug. I love you more than that old baseball. Agape. Unconditional, sacrificial love. Your gentleness made me great. Talk about being salt and light. That's beautiful. Jesus, help us to become more like you. Amen.